Chapter 21. Academy Slope was what Headmaster Ardai and his one remaining pupil called the long, rolling hill that dropped from the campus to the main road. The grass was still bright green and only beginning to be littered with fallen leaves. When afternoon gave way to early evening and Academy Slope was still empty, no sign of returning phone crazies, Alice began to pace the main hall of Cheatham Lodge, pausing in each circuit only long enough to look out the bay window of the living room. It offered a fine view of the slope, the two main lecture halls, and Tunney Field. The sneaker was once more tied to her wrist. The others were in the kitchen, sipping cokes from cans.
"They're not coming back," she told them at the end of one of her circuits. "They got wind of what we were planning, read our minds or something, and they're not coming."
Two more circuits of the long downstairs hall, each with a pause to look out the big living room window, and then she looked in on them again.
"Or maybe it's a general migration. Did you guys ever think of that? Maybe they go south in the winter like the goddamn robins."
She was gone without waiting for a reply. Up the hall and down the hall. Up and down the hall.
"She's like Ahab on the prod for Moby," the head remarked.
"M&M might have been a jerk, but he was right about that guy," Tom said morosely.
"I beg your pardon, Tom," the head asked.
Tom waved it away. Jordan glanced at his watch.
"They didn't come back last night until almost half an hour later than it is right now," he said. "I'll go tell her that if you want."
"I don't think it would do any good," Clay said. "She's got to work through it, that's all."
"She's pretty freaked out, isn't she, sir?"
"Aren't you, Jordan?"
"Yes,"
Jordan said in a small voice.
"I'm Freak City."
The next time Alice came back to the kitchen, she said,
"Maybe it's best if they don't come back. I don't know if they're rebooting their brains some new way, but for sure there's some bad voodoo going on. I felt it from those two this afternoon, the woman with the book and the man with the Twinkies."
She shook her head.
"Bad voodoo."
She plunged off on hall patrol again before anyone could reply, the sneaker swinging from her wrist. The head looked at Jordan.
"Did you feel anything, son?"
Jordan hesitated, then said,
"I felt something. The hair on my neck tried to stand up."
Now the head turned his gaze to the men on the other side of the table.
"What about you two? You were far closer."
Alice saved them from having to answer. She ran into the kitchen, her cheeks flushed, her eyes wide, the soles of her sneakers squeaking on the tiles.
"They're coming," she said.
Chapter 22. From the bay window, the five of them watched the phone crazies come up Academy Slope in converging lines, their long shadows making a huge pinwheel shape on the green grass. As they neared what Jordan and the head called Tunney Arch, the lines drew together, and the pinwheel seemed to spin in the late golden sunlight, even as it contracted and solidified. Alice could no longer stand not holding the sneaker. She had torn it from her wrist and was squeezing it compulsively.
"They'll see what we did and they'll turn around," she said, speaking low and rapidly. "They've gotten at least that smart. If they're picking up books again, they must have."
"We'll see," Clay said. He was almost positive the phone crazies would go on to Tunney Field, even if what they saw there disquieted their strange group mind. It would be dark soon, and they had nowhere else to go. A fragment of a lullaby his mother used to sing him floated through his mind. "Little man, you've had a busy day."
"I hope they go and I hope they stay," she said,
lower than ever.
"I feel like I'm going to explode."
She gave a wild little laugh.
"Only it's them that's supposed to explode, isn't it? Them?"
Tom turned to look at her and she said,
"I'm all right, I'm fine, so just close your mouth."
"All I was going to say is that it'll be what it is," he said.
"New age crap. You sound like my father, the picture frame king."
A tear rolled down one cheek, and she rubbed it impatiently away with the heel of her hand.
"Just calm down, Alice. Watch." "I'll try, okay? I'll try."
"And stop with the sneaker," Jordan said, irritably for him. "That squelchy sound is making me crazy." She looked down at the sneaker, as if surprised, then slipped it around her wrist on its loop again. They watched as the phone crazies converged at Tunney Arch, and passed beneath it with less pushing and confusion than any crowd attending the homecoming weekend's soccer match could ever have equaled. Clay was sure of that. They watched as the crazies spread out again on the far side, crossing the concourse and filing down the ramps. They waited to see that steady march slow and stop, but it never did. The last stragglers, most of them hurt and helping each other along but still walking in those close groups, were in long before the reddening sun had passed below the dormitories on the west side of the Gayton Academy campus. They had returned once more, like homing pigeons to their nests or the swallows to Capistrano. Not 5 minutes after the evening star became visible in the darkening sky, Dean Martin began singing, "Everybody Loves Somebody Sometime."
"I was worried for nothing, wasn't I?" Alice said. "Sometimes I'm a putz. That's what my father says."
"No," the head told her. "All the putzes had cell phones, dear. That's why they're out there, and you're in here with us."
Tom said, "I wonder if Rafe's still making out okay."
"I wonder if Johnny is," Clay said. "Johnny and Sharon."
Chapter 23. At 10 o'clock on that windy autumn night, under a moon now entering its last quarter, Clay and Tom stood in the band alcove at the home end of the Tunney soccer field. Directly in front of them was a waist-high concrete barrier that had been heavily padded on the playing field side. On their side were a few rusting music stands and a drift of litter that was ankle-deep. The wind blew the torn bags and scraps of paper in here, and here they came to rest. Behind and above them, back at the turnstiles, Alice and Jordan flanked the head, a tall figure propped on a slender rod of cane. Debbie Boone's voice rolled across the field in amplified waves of comic majesty. Ordinarily, she would be followed by Leanne Womack singing, "I Hope You Dance," then back to Lawrence Welk and his champagne music makers. But perhaps not tonight. The wind was freshening. It brought them the smell of rotting bodies from the marsh behind the indoor track building, and the aroma of dirt and sweat from the living ones packed together on the field beyond the band alcove. "If you can call that living," Clay thought, and flashed himself a small and bitter inside smile. Rationalization was a great human sport, maybe the great human sport, but he would not fool himself tonight. Of course they called it living. Whatever they were, or whatever they were becoming, they called it living just as he did.
"What are you waiting for?" Tom murmured.
"Nothing," Clay murmured back. "Just nothing." From the holster Alice had found in the Nickerson basement, Clay drew Beth Nickerson's old-fashioned Colt 45 revolver, now once more fully loaded. Alice had offered him the automatic rifle, which so far they had not even test-fired, and he had refused, saying that if the pistol didn't do the job, probably nothing would.
"I don't know why the auto wouldn't be better, if it squirts 30 or 40 bullets a second," she said. "You could turn those trucks into cheese graters."
He had agreed that this might be so, but reminded Alice that their object tonight was not destruction per se, but ignition. Then he'd explained the highly illegal nature of the ammunition Arnie Nickerson had obtained for his wife's 45. Fraggers. What had once been called dum-dum bullets.
"Okay, but if it doesn't work, you can still try Sir Speedy," she'd said. "Unless the guys out there just, you know."
She wouldn't actually use the word attack, but had made a little walking motion with the fingers of the hand not holding the sneaker.
"In that case, beat feet."
The wind tore a tattered strip of homecoming weekend bunting free of the scoreboard and sent it dancing above the packed sleepers. Around the field, seeming to float in the dark, were the red eyes of the boomboxes, all but one playing without benefit of CDs. The bunting struck the bumper of one of the propane trucks, flapped there several seconds, then slipped free and flew off into the night. The trucks were parked side by side in the middle of the field, rising from the mass of packed forms like weird metal mesas. The phone crazies slept beneath them, and so closely around them that some were crammed up against the wheels. Clay thought again of passenger pigeons and the way 19th-century hunters had brained them on the ground with clubs.
The whole species had been wiped out by the beginning of the 20th. But of course they'd only been birds, with little bird brains, incapable of rebooting.
Clay? Tom asked, low. Are you sure you want to go through with this?
No, Clay said. Now that he was face to face with it, there were too many unanswered questions. What they would do if it went wrong was only one of them. What they would do if it went right was another. Because passenger pigeons were incapable of revenge. Those things out there, on the other hand. But I'm going to.
Then do it, Tom said. Because all else aside, you light up my life blows dead rats in hell.
Clay raised the .45 and held his right wrist firmly with his left hand. He centered the gun sight on the tank of the truck on the left. He would fire twice into that one, then twice into the other one. That would leave one more bullet for each, if necessary. If that didn't work, he could try the automatic weapon Alice had taken to calling Sir Speedy.
Duck if it goes up, he told Tom. Don't worry, Tom said.
His face was drawn into a grimace, anticipating the report of the gun and whatever might follow. Debbie Boone was building to a big finish. It suddenly seemed very important to Clay that he beat her. If you miss at this range, you're a monkey, he thought, and pulled the trigger. There was no chance for a second shot, and no need of one. A bright red flower bloomed in the center of the tank, and by its light he saw a deep dent in the previously smooth metal surface. Hell appeared to be inside, and growing. Then the flower was a river, red turning orange-white.
Down!
He shouted, and pushed Tom's shoulder. He fell on top of the smaller man just as the night became desert noon. There was a huge, whooshing roar, followed by a guttering bang that Clay felt in every bone of his body. Shrapnel shot overhead. He thought Tom screamed, but he wasn't sure, because there was another of those whooshing roars, and suddenly the air was growing hot, hot, hot. He seized Tom partly by the scruff of the neck and partly by the collar of his shirt and began to drag him backward up the concrete ramp leading to the turnstiles, his eyes slitted almost completely shut against the enormous glare flowing from the center of the soccer field. Something enormous landed in the auxiliary stands to his right. He thought maybe an engine block. He was pretty sure the shattered bits and twists of metal under his feet had once been Gayton Academy music stands. Tom was screaming, and his glasses were askew, but he was on his feet, and he looked intact. The two of them ran up the ramp like escapees from Gomorrah. Clay could see their shadows, long and spider-thin in front of them, and realized objects were falling all around them. Arms, legs, a piece of bumper, a woman's head with the hair blazing. From behind them came a second tremendous bang, or maybe it was a third, and this time he was the one who screamed. His feet tangled and he went sprawling. The whole world was rapidly building heat and the most incredible light. He felt as if he were standing on God's personal soundstage.
We didn't know what we were doing, he thought, looking at a wad of gum, a tromped junior mince box, a blue Pepsi Cola cap. We didn't have a clue, and we're going to pay with our fucking lives. Get up!
That was Tom, and he thought Tom was screaming, but his voice seemed to be coming from a mile away. He felt Tom's delicate, long-fingered hands yanking at his arm. Then Alice was there, too. Alice was yanking on his other arm, and she was glaring in the light. He could see the sneaker dancing and bobbing from its string on her wrist. She was spattered with blood, bits of cloth, and gobbets of smoking flesh. Clay scrambled up, then went back to one knee, and Alice hauled him up again by main force. From behind them, propane roared like a dragon. And here came Jordan, with the head tottering along right behind him, his face rosy and every wrinkle running with sweat.
No, Jordan, no! Just get him out of the way!
Tom yelled, and Jordan pulled the head aside for them, gripping the old man grimly around the waist when he tottered. A burning torso with a ring in its navel landed at Alice's feet, and she booted it off the ramp. 5 years of soccer, Clay remembered her saying. A blazing piece of shirt landed on the back of her head, and Clay swept it aside before it could set her hair on fire. At the top of the ramp, a blazing truck tire with half a sheared-off axle still attached leaned against the last row of reserved seats. If it had landed blocking their way, they might have cooked, The head almost certainly would have. As it was, they were able to slide past, holding their breath against billows of oily smoke. A moment later, they were lurching through the turnstile, Jordan on one side of the head and Clay on the other, the two of them almost carrying the old man along. Clay had his ear boxed twice by the head's flailing cane, but 30 seconds after passing the tire, they were standing beneath Tunney Arch, looking back at the huge column of fire rising above the bleachers and center press box with identical expressions of stupefied disbelief. A blazing rag of homecoming bunting floated down to the pavement next to the main ticket booth, trailing a few sparks before coming to rest.
"Did you know that would happen?" Tom asked.
His face was white around the eyes, red across the forehead and cheeks. Half his mustache appeared to have been singed off. Clay could hear his voice, but it sounded distant. Everything did. It was as if his ears had been packed with cotton balls, or the shooter's plugs Beth Nickerson's husband Arnie had no doubt made her wear when he took her to their favorite target range, where they'd probably shot with their cell phones clipped to one hip and their pagers to the other.
"Did you know?"
Tom attempted to shake him, got nothing but a piece of his shirt, and tore it all the way down the front.
"Fuck no! Are you insane?"
Clay's voice was beyond hoarse, beyond parched. It sounded baked.
"You think I would have stood there with a pistol if I'd known? If it hadn't been for that concrete barrier, we would have been cut in two. Or vaporized."
Incredibly, Tom began to grin.
"I tore your shirt, Batman."
Clay felt like knocking his head off. Also like hugging and kissing him just because he was still alive.
"I want to go back to the lodge," Jordan said.
The fear in his voice was unmistakable.
"By all means, let us remove to a safe distance," the head agreed.
He was trembling badly, his eyes fixed on the inferno rising above the arch and the bleachers.
"Thank God the wind's blowing toward Academy Slope."
"Can you walk, sir?" Tom asked.
"Thank you, yes. If Jordan will assist me, I'm sure I can walk as far as the lodge."
"We got them," Alice said. She was wiping splatters of gore almost absently from her face, leaving smears of blood. Her eyes were like nothing Clay had ever seen except in a few photographs and some inspired comic art from the 1950s and 60s. He remembered going to a comics convention once, only a kid himself then, and listening to Wallace Wood talk about trying to draw something he called panic eye. Now Clay was seeing it in the face of a 15-year-old suburban schoolgirl. "Alice, come on," he said. "We have to go back to the lodge and get our shit together. We have to get out of here." As soon as the words were out of his mouth, he had to say them again and hear if they had the ring of truth. The second time they sounded more than true. They sounded scared. She might not have heard. She looked exultant, stuffed with triumph, sick with it, like a kid who has eaten too much Halloween candy on the way home. The pupils of her eyes were full of fire.
"Nothing could live through that."
Tom gripped Clay's arm. It hurt the way a sunburn hurt.
"What's wrong with you?"
"I think we made a mistake," Clay said.
"Is it like in the gas station?"
Tom asked him. Behind his crooked spectacles, his eyes were sharp.
"When the man and woman were fighting over the damn twink?"
"No, I just think we made a mistake," Clay said. Actually, it was stronger than that. He knew they had made a mistake. "Come on. We have to go tonight."
"If you say so, okay," Tom said. "Come on, Alice."
She went with them a little way down the path toward the lodge, where they had left a pair of gas lanterns burning in the big bay window, then turned back for another look. The press box was on fire now, and the bleachers. The stars over the soccer field were gone. Even the moon was nothing but a ghost dancing a wild jig in the heat haze above that fierce gas jet.
"They're dead. They're gone. They're crispy," she said. "Burn, baby, burn."
That was when the cry rose, only now it wasn't coming from Glens Falls or Littleton 10 miles away. It was coming from right behind them. Nor was there anything spectral or wraith-like about it. It was a cry of agony. The scream of something, a single entity, and aware, Clay was certain of it, that had awakened from deep sleep to find it was burning alive. Alice shrieked and covered her ears, her eyes bulging in the firelight.
"Take it back,"
Jordan said, grasping the head's wrist.
Sir, we have to take it back.
Too late, Jordan, Ardai said.
Chapter 24. Their knapsacks were a little plumper as they leaned against the front door of Cheatham Lodge an hour later. There were a couple of shirts in each one, plus bags of trail mix, juice boxes, and packets of Slim Jims, as well as batteries and spare flashlights. Clay had harried Tom and Alice into sweeping their possessions together as quickly as possible, and now he was the one who kept darting into the living room to steal looks out the big window. The gas jet over there was finally starting to burn low, but the bleachers were still blazing, and so was the press box. Tunney Arch itself had caught and glared in the night like a horseshoe in a smithy. Nothing that had been on that field could still be alive. Alice had been right about that much, surely. But twice on their return to the lodge, the head shambling like an old drunk in spite of their best efforts to support him, they had heard those ghostly cries coming down the wind from other flocks. Clay told himself he didn't hear anger in those cries. It was just his imagination. His guilty imagination. His murderer's imagination. His mass murderer's imagination. But he didn't completely believe it. It had been a mistake. But what else could they have done? He and Tom had felt their gathering power just that afternoon, had seen it, and that had been only two of them, just two. How could they have let that go on? Just let it grow.
Damned if you do, damned if you stand pat, he said under his breath, and turned from the window.
He didn't even know how long he'd been looking at the burning stadium, and resisted the urge to check his watch. It would be easy to give in to the panic rat. He was close to it now. And if he gave in, it would travel to the others quickly, starting with Alice. Alice had managed to get herself back under some sort of control, but it was thin. Thin enough to read a newspaper through, his bingo-playing mother might have said. Although a kid herself, Alice had managed to keep herself shiny side up mostly for the other kid's sake, so he wouldn't give way entirely. The other kid, Jordan. Clay hurried back into the front hall, noted there was still no fourth pack by the door, and saw Tom coming down the stairs, alone. "Where's the kid?" Clay asked. His ears had started to clear a little, but his voice still sounded too far away, and like a stranger's. He had an idea that was going to continue for a while. "You were supposed to be helping him put some stuff together. Ardai said he brought a pack over with him from that dorm of his. He won't come." Tom rubbed the side of his face. He looked tired, sad, distracted. With half his mustache gone, he looked ludicrous as well.
What?
Lower your voice, Clay. I don't make the news, I just report it.
Then tell me what you're talking about, for Christ's sake.
He won't go without the head. He said you can't make me. And if you're really serious about going tonight, I believe he's right.
Alice came tearing out of the kitchen. She had washed up, tied her hair back, and put on a new shirt. It hung almost to her knees, but her skin glowed with the same burn Clay felt on his own. He supposed they should count themselves lucky they weren't popping blisters.
Alice, he began, I need you to exercise your womanly powers over Jordan. She steamed past as if he hadn't spoken, fell on her knees, seized her pack, and tore it open. He watched, perplexed, as she began to pull out the stuff inside. He looked at Tom and saw an expression of understanding and sympathy dawning on Tom's face.
What? Clay asked. What, for Christ's sake?
He had felt an all too similar exasperated annoyance toward Sharon during the last year they'd actually lived together, had felt it often, and hated himself for having that pop up now, of all times. But damn it, another complication was the last thing they needed now. He ran his hands through his hair.
What?
Look at her wrist, Tom said. Clay looked. The dirty piece of shoestring was still there, but the sneaker was gone. He felt an absurd sinking in his stomach. Or maybe it wasn't so absurd. If it mattered to Alice, he supposed it mattered. So what if it was just a sneaker? The spare t-shirt and sweatshirt she had packed, Gayton Boosters Club printed across the front, went flying. Batteries rolled. Her spare flashlight hit the tile floor, and the lens cover cracked. That was enough to convince Clay.
This wasn't a Sharon Riddell tantrum because they were out of hazelnut coffee or chunky monkey ice cream. This was unvarnished terror. He went to Alice, knelt beside her, and took hold of her wrists. He could feel the seconds flying by, turning into minutes they should have been using to put this town behind them, but he could also feel the lightning sprint of her pulse under his fingers. And he could see her eyes. It wasn't panic in them now, but agony, and he realized she'd put everything in that sneaker. Her mother and father, her friends, Beth Nickerson and her daughter, the Tunney Field Inferno, everything.
"It's not in here," she cried. "I thought I must have packed it, but I didn't. I can't find it anywhere."
"No, honey, I know." Clay was still holding her wrists. Now he lifted the one with the shoelace around it. "Do you see?" He waited until he was sure her eyes had focused. Then he flipped the ends beyond the knot, where there had been a second knot.
"It's too long now," she said. "It wasn't that long before."
Clay tried to remember the last time he'd seen the sneaker. He told himself it was impossible to remember a thing like that, given all that had been going on, then realized he could. Very clearly, too. It was when she'd helped Tom pull him up after the second truck had exploded. It had been dancing from its string then. She had been covered with blood, scraps of cloth, and little chunks of flesh, but the sneaker had still been on her wrist. He tried to remember if it was still there when she'd booted the burning torso off the ramp. He didn't think so. Maybe that was hindsight, but he didn't think so. "It came untied, honey," he said. "It came untied and fell off."
"I lost it?"
Her eyes unbelieving. The first tears.
"Are you sure?"
"Pretty sure, yeah."
"It was my luck,"
she whispered, the tears spilling over. "No," Tom said, and put an arm around her. "We're your luck." She looked at him.
"How do you know?"
"Because you found us first," Tom said, "and we're still here." She hugged them both, and they stood that way for a while, the three of them, with their arms around each other in the hall, with Alice's few possessions scattered around their feet. Chapter 25.
The fire spread to a lecture building the head identified as Hackery Hall. Then, around 4 a.m., the wind dropped away, and it spread no farther.
When the sun came up, the Gayton campus stank of propane, charred wood, and a great many burnt bodies. The bright sky of a perfect New England morning in October was obscured by a rising column of gray-black smoke, and Cheatham Lodge was still occupied. In the end, it had been like dominoes. The head couldn't travel except by car. Car travel was impossible, and Jordan would not go without the head. Nor was Ardai able to persuade him. Alice, although resigned to the loss of her talisman, refused to go without Jordan. Tom would not go without Alice. And Clay was loath to go without the two of them, although he was horrified to find these newcomers in his life seemed at least temporarily more important than his own son, and although he continued to feel certain that they would pay a high price for what they'd done on Tunney Field if they stayed in Gayton, let alone at the scene of the crime. He thought he might feel better about that last at daybreak, but he did not. The five of them watched and waited at the living room window, but of course nothing came out of the smoldering wreckage, and there was no sound but the low crackle of fire eating deep into the athletic department offices and locker rooms, even as it finished off the bleachers above ground. The thousand or so phone crazies who had been roosting there were, as Alice had said, crispy. The smell of them was rich and stick-in-your-throat awful. Clay had vomited once and knew the others had as well, even the head. "We made a mistake," he thought again.
"You guys should have gone on," Jordan said. "We would have been all right. We were before, weren't we, sir?"
Headmaster Ardai ignored the question. He was studying Clay.
"What happened yesterday when you and Tom were in that service station? I think something happened then to make you look as you do now."
"Oh? How do I look, sir?"
"Like an animal that smells a trap. Did those two in the street see you?"
"It wasn't exactly that," Clay said. He didn't love being called an animal, but couldn't deny that was what he was. Oxygen and food in, carbon dioxide and shit out. Pop goes the weasel. The head had begun to rub restlessly at the left side of his midsection with one big hand. Like many of his gestures, Clay thought it had an oddly theatrical quality. Not exactly phony, but meant to be seen at the back of the lecture hall.
Then what exactly was it?
And because protecting the others no longer seemed like an option, Clay told the head exactly what they'd seen in the office of the Sitgo station. A physical struggle over a box of stale treats that had suddenly turned into something else. He told about the fluttering papers, the ashes that had begun circling in the ashtray like water going down a bathtub drain, the keys jingling on the board, the nozzle that fell off the gas pump.
I saw that, Jordan said, and Alice nodded.
Tom mentioned feeling short of breath, and Clay agreed. They both tried to explain the sense of something powerful building in the air. Clay said it was how things felt before a thunderstorm. Tom said the air just felt fraught somehow, too heavy.
Then he let her take a couple of the fucking things and it all went away, Tom said. The ashes stopped spinning, the keys stopped jingling, that thundery feeling went out of the air.
He looked to Clay for confirmation. Clay nodded. Alice said,
Why didn't you tell us this before?
Because it wouldn't have changed anything, Clay said. We were going to burn the nest if we could, regardless.
Yes, Tom said. Jordan said suddenly, You think the phone crazies are turning into psionics, don't you?
Tom said, I don't know what that word means, Jordan.
People who can move things around just by thinking about it, for one thing. Or by accident, if their emotions get out of control. Only psionic abilities like telekinesis and levitation.
Levitation, Alice almost barked. Jordan paid no mind.
Are only branches. The trunk of the psionic tree is telepathy, and that's what you're afraid of, isn't it? The telepathy thing.
Tom's fingers went to the place above his mouth where half of his mustache was gone and touched the reddened skin there.
Well, the thought has crossed my mind.
He paused, head cocked.
That might be witty. I'm not sure.
Jordan ignored this as well.
Say that they are. Getting to be true telepaths, I mean, and not just zombies with a flocking instinct. So what? The Gaten Academy flock is dead, and they died without a clue of who lit them up, because they died in whatever passes for sleep with them. So if you're worrying that they telepathically faxed our names and descriptions to any of their buddies in the surrounding New England states, you can relax.
Jordan, the head began, then winced. He was still rubbing his midsection.
Sir, are you all right?
Yes. Fetch my Zantac from the downstairs bathroom, would you? And a bottle of the Poland spring water. There's a good lad.
Jordan hurried away on the errand. Not an ulcer, is it? Tom asked.
No, the head replied. It's stress. An old, one cannot say, friend, acquaintance.
Your heart okay?
Alice asked, speaking in a low voice.
I suppose, the head agreed and bared his teeth in a smile of disconcerting jollity. If the Zantac doesn't work, we may resuppose. But so far the Zantac always has, and one doesn't care to buy trouble when so much of it is on sale. Ah, Jordan, thank you.
Quite welcome, sir.
The boy handed him the glass and the pill with his usual smile.
I think you ought to go with them,
Ardai told him after swallowing the Zantac.
Sir, with all respect, I'm telling you there's no way they could know. No way!
The head looked a question at Tom and Clay. Tom raised his hands. Clay only shrugged. He could say what he felt right out loud, could articulate what they surely must know he felt. We made a mistake, and staying here is compounding it, but saw no point. Jordan's face was set and stubborn on top, scared to death just beneath. They were not going to persuade him, and besides, it was day again. Day was their time. He rumpled the boy's hair. If you say so, Jordan, I'm going to catch some winks. Jordan looked almost sublimely relieved.
That sounds like a good idea. I think I will too.
I'm going to have a cup of Cheatham Lodge's world-famous tepid cocoa before I come up, Tom said. And I believe I'll shave off the rest of this mustache. The wailing and lamentation you hear will be mine.
Can I watch? Alice asked. I always wanted to watch a grown man wail and lament.